Erev Tov. Everybody has two sheets? Okay. So, it's good to be back here again. This is, we try to do this annually. Three of my four grandparents passed away during the period of Sfirat HaOmer. Not in the same year, but within 9 years of each other. My grandfather, Eliyahu ben Baruch Halevi, his yard site is Erev Shavuos, which is next Shabbos, and it was the Shabbos on the day that when he passed away, it was a Shabbos. And my grandmother, Ruth Levy, Rivka Bas Moshe, passed away on Chav Zayin Nisan about 17 years ago. Chav Vav Nisan, 17 years ago. And my paternal grandfather, Ze'ev Yehuda, Harav Ze'ev Yehuda ben Moshe, passed away on Yud Ches Nisan, on the beginning of Chol Hamoed Pesach, about 23 years ago. So this is, we try to do this, an annual shiur in their memory. During the time of Sfirat HaOmer, usually ends up being some point between Lag BaOmer and Shavuot. And what we usually explore is what I like to call something at the intersection of Halakha and Agadah, right? We're used to thinking of Halakha and Agadah as binary categories. It's one or the other. The Gemara itself, even though there are parts of the Gemara that are halacha and parts of the Gemara that are agadah, the Gemara doesn't distinguish which parts are supposed to be law, which parts are not supposed to be law, which parts are normative, which parts are not. It's really in the time of the Gaonim, the time of Rav Saadia Gaon and Rav Hai Gaon and Rav Shmuel ben Chofni Gaon. They're the ones who start saying, okay, there's halacha, there's agadah. Halacha is the kind of thing we learn from Agadah. That's, we don't derive what we're supposed to do from that. But the truth is a lot more complicated. And so that's what we've been exploring in recent years, how Halacha and Agadah inform each other. Tonight, we're not really going to look at the Gemara. In fact, I don't think there's going to be a single Gemara in this source sheet. And nevertheless, it's going to be about a medrash that somehow works its way into halacha, and we're going to talk about how that happens, why that happens. So we're going to start from the end. Okay, we're going to start from the end because this is how we're going to pose the question. Okay, the first source is from Minchat Asher, or Minchas Asher. So I know that a number of you are familiar with this work. I know that Mike is familiar with this work because I actually borrowed his copy of it at some point. Eventually, I returned it, right, after a number of years. And I think it was this volume on Sefer Shemot. It's written by Rav Usher Weiss, whose shiur I try to attend regularly in Ramot on Thursday nights, and I'm actually skipping his shiur to give this shiur. So what he does is it's organized by Parsha, and he gives a halacha shiur based on the Parsha every week, and it's collected into a number of volumes. So he has a book, you know, he has books where there are these halachic essays organized by Parsha. So the Parsha of Shmos, right? So he always starts off with a connection between the Parsha and some halachic issue. So the Parsha of Shmos, he starts off quoting a Bala Turim. Because of Bala Turim, Shmos b'nei Yisrael haba'im, Roshei Tevot Shivya, Shmot Bnei Yisrael Habayim Shin Bet Yud Hei, She'af Kishahayu B'Shivya, even though they were in captivity, it was Shmot Bnei Yisrael Habayim, Loshinu Shmotam. They didn't change their names. Okay? And so Bal HaTurim, his style is that he has these elusive, acrostic-type comments where he finds hints for broader ideas in the words of the Chumash. And he says that this alludes to A medrash, the Bishvil Dalad Devarim Nigalumi Mitzrayim, that it was in the merit of four things that the Israelites were redeemed from Egypt. What are the four? Bishvil Shaloshinu Shmotam V'chulei U'mukoro B'vayikra Rabba Emor. Vayikra Rabba in Emor, right? We can actually skip to the second source so you can see it. Rav Huna b'shem Bar Kapara b'shvil Arba'a Dvarim Nigalu Yisrael Mitzrayim. Right, it's on the first page. You'll see it's bolded Vayikra Rabba. There are four things: Shloshinu et Shman, Shloshinu et Lishonam, Al Yedei Shelo Amru Lashon Hara, Ba'al Yedei Shelo Hayabahem Parutz Erva. They didn't change their names. They didn't change their language. They didn't speak Lashon Hara. In this context, and in context of parallel Midrashim, it's clear when it says they didn't speak Lashon Hara on each other, it means they didn't inform on each other to the Egyptians. Right? If something went down in the Jewish neighborhood, nobody saw nothing. All right? Nobody told the cops anything. Okay? That's L'dibru Lashon Hara. And Lo Haya Bahem Parutz Be'erva. They weren't promiscuous. Okay. V'hine nish'alti, as Rav Asher continues. So I've been asked, L'gabei rabbi me'achinu b'medidot hayam sh'no again l'ishtamish b'iskeim v'kishreim im ha'goyim b'shemot nochriyim. How can this be? We know all of these Jews who live in Medinat Hayam, right? They don't live in flyover states. They only live on the coasts. They live in America, basically, who use non-Jewish names, Gentile names, in their business associations. Hayim Ovrim Be'isur. Is that forbidden? V'im Ra'oi L'nhogkin. And is that something that we should be doing? V'na'avor al parshat Adah. Okay, so let's deal with this issue. That's how he opens up his essay. So we're not going to read the whole thing inside. But what we are going to do is we're going to outline the steps that he takes. The first thing that he says is that, okay, there have been various opinions. And he quotes two machmirim. The two machmirim are Maram Shik and Maharshag, Rav Shimon Greenfeld, both Hungarian poskim. Maharam lived, was active in the 1800s. He passed away in 1879, major Hungarian posek, lived toward the end of his life in the city of Chust. Earlier part of his life, he was from Western Slovakia, but then was part of Hungary. And Maharshag, Rav Shimon Greenfeld, passed away in 1930, and he was one of the major Hungarian poskim of his day. And it's not odd to see Rav Asher quoting them. Rav Asher is a Hungarian Hasidisha, like that's his background. He grew up as a Kleisenberger Chassid. He's still a Kleisenberger Chassid, or he's still a Chassid, and that's his Nechtzei Tzon Barzel. That's his cultural heritage, right? He's going to quote the Hungarians first, okay? And he quotes these two as saying that it's Asur Mi De'oraita, it's a Torah prohibition, it's Chukot HaGoyim, it's a violation of Va'avdil Etchem in Ha'amim, the Jews are supposed to be separate. And after quoting sources back and forth, he comes up with the two sources that he ends up accepting. And now these two sources are a little bit different, not what you would expect. He quotes two sources, one Maharsham, that's Rav Shmuel D. Medina, who was a Sephardic Rav who lived in Salonika. Now, today that's Greece. It was part of the Ottoman Empire. And he lived in the 1500s. And Maharitatz, Rav Yom Tov Tzahalon, who also lived in the late 1500s and early 1600s, also in the Ottoman Empire. And they were both dealing with questions of conversos, crypto-Jews, Jews who had been forcibly converted in Spain or in Portugal, and who took on outward appearances of Gentiles. They had to. It was life-threatening. And slowly, over the years, they trickled out of Portugal, and they went pretty much everywhere. They went to Amsterdam, they went to Italy, and a lot of them went to the Ottoman Empire. A lot of them came to Eretz Israel, which was part of the Ottoman Empire. And so a lot of them had these Gentile names. And a lot of times when they would be writing back and forth, communicating with relatives that were still living in the Alter Heim in Spain and Portugal, they had to keep up appearances. Right? And these were some of the questions that were coming up. They're saying, let's say a woman brings, you know, she shows up with a get from Portugal. And the only people, the people that are signing on the get are people that are signing with Christian names. Because they don't have any other names. Is that a pasul get? Can you consider such a person to be a kosher aid? These are the kinds of questions that they're dealing with. And in both cases, Rav Yom Tov Maharit Tzahalon and Maharashtam both rule, both conclude, that there is no iser. Right? And so you can see the last two lines of the fourth paragraph. Va'af yesh isur lihidamot legoi bakol haino belavusham ulshonam mikol makum ein isur lihishtameish b'shemot nachriyim. Sorry, this is Rav Usher speaking. Uchedvarav gam kein maharit tzahalon. By the way, Maharashtam doesn't actually say anything about levusham and lishonam. But it's neither here nor there. Right now we're discussing just the names. Right, Maharit Tzahalon. Also, when it comes to Anusim, they both say there's no Isur. So now, Rav Usher, having concluded that there is no such Isur, that it is not prohibited to use a Gentile name, he circles back to the Medrash. Saying, okay, so how do these people understand the Medrash? But he doesn't circle back to the Medrash. He circles back to something a little bit differently. Now here, the bolded sections are actually bolded in the original. Efshar lefi darkam lefaresh. So if we accept them, how can we explain the Medrash? It says, lefaresh et divrei chazal shaloshinu et shumam l'shonam ulevusham. Right? That statement of chazal, that they didn't change their name, their language, and their dress. How can we understand that? He says, "Dainu ikar hakpeda shelo lishanot shloshtam yachad." You can't change all three at the same time. The bekach batel kol heker sheyisraelu. That means you're completely unrecognizable as a Jew. You tama ben out nochrim, and you'll completely assimilate. Avol eini sor kasher no heg hu bechol davar ki Yisrael. Umishum tzorech misuyam kigon mischar hu mishanesh shmo o levusho o lishono. So there's no problem if, because of some need, he changes one of them. Okay? And then he even goes back and says, and he rereads the Maharshik by contextualizing him. He says, "Uve'emet, the truth is, hayanira degam kavanata maramshik eno ela b'misha mishtamish b'shemot nachriyim kidei lihidamot bahem." No, when the Maram Shik says that it's usher to use a Gentile name, it's only if you're doing it in order to assimilate. Right? Like the reformers and like the free thinkers of his generation. But nowadays, there are many proud, observant Jews who use their names in their dealings, in their commerce. There's no Isser at all. Okay? And then he circles, he comes back again, and he says that, but of course, Loshinu Shmam Loshonam Malvusham is Torah Netzach. It's always applicable. Even nowadays, it still applies. We all know that the Chasam Sofer wrote in his will that his children shouldn't change. He says Shalem stands for Shem Lashon Malbush. That only talks about somebody that's changing these things in order to assimilate. And then he hedges again. But you really shouldn't do it. You should really try to keep your Jewish name. Okay. So there are a whole bunch of questions here, but I'm going to focus on two. Meaning just in terms of the entire structure of the argument. The two questions are these. One is there is this principle, and Rav Asher quotes it on other occasions, of Ein Lemedin Min Ha'agadot. We don't derive halacha from agadic statements. Now, it's quite possible that there are some who took this agadic statement as being normative, that Shaloshinu Shmam Lushonam Malbusham somehow was intended as a normative statement. I hear that. But why does he see the need, right, to answer for Marashdam and Maharitza alone by interpreting the Medrash on their behalf? Right? Why does he... Is it so obvious to him? It's such a foregone conclusion to him that this Medrash is normative, that this Medrash can't be ignored as something that's a matter of law, a matter of practice, that he has to answer for early Achronim that lived in the 15 and 1600s. And more than that, I mean, why couldn't he just say, like, ah, so how can we answer this Medrash according to Maharashdam? Okay, Ein Lemedin Min Ha'agadot. Right? So he didn't learn halacha from this Agada. Okay, Maharam Shik did. He didn't. Fine. But he's not okay with that. He has to answer it. If he's going to accept this as an opinion, it's almost as though he can't get out of answering it. Right? And he answers it in a very clever and very creative way that I don't know if you're convinced by it, that that's what that medrash meant, that lo shinu et shmam lo shonam lo vusham meant that they didn't change all three at the same time, but they could change any one or two. That doesn't seem so compelling to me. Same question is, you have Vayikra Rabbah. Now, Vayikra Rabbah is a very early medrash, right? You're talking about in the 7th century, maybe the 6th century, the 500s, the 600s. And the truth of the matter is that that Medrash is actually even a little bit earlier. It goes back to the Mechilta, which is really one of the earliest Midrashim. That goes back to the 3rd century. And they both give these two lists. They both give these lists of four things, right? Lo shinu et shmam, lashonam, lo amru lashon hara, and lo haya behem parutz be'erva. So where does he get this shame lashon malbush thing from? And why, wherever he gets it from, is he privileging that, and is he using that over these much earlier and much more pedigreed midrashim? Midrashim were compiled, they weren't all compiled at the same time. They were compiled, the midrashim that we have today were compiled over a period of probably about 1,000 years, maybe a little bit more. For example, the Mechilta, I've mentioned, the Mechilta and the Midrashei Halacha, Mechilta, Sifra, Sifrei, those are from the time of the Tanaim. Those go back to the 200s. Vayikra Rabbah and Breshit Rabbah, Shira Shirim Rabbah, they're amongst the earlier, what we call Midrashei Agadah. Right? There's Agada in the Mechilta, there's Halacha in it. But we call them Midrashei Agada, meaning they're not Tanaitic Midrashim. Some of the other ones are later, right? Bamidbar Rabbah, for example, that doesn't come together until the 1100s. Yalkut Shimoni is even later. Yalkut Shimoni, some don't even recognize it as, like, it's like 1300s. But Mechilta and Vayikra Rabbah, they're from the earliest. They're from the most pedigreed. Okay? So where does this Medrash come from, and why does Rav Asher privilege it? So now we're going to go through a little bit of a history of the Midrashim that talk about these lists. This is what the Jews did. This is what the Jews kept in Egypt. Okay, so Pirkei DeRabbi Eliezer, apparently I forgot to paste it in here. Pirkei DeRabbi Eliezer is also, it's a relatively early Medrash, 7th century. It has a list of three things, right? I didn't actually look it up here, because it's clear that it was just a bridge to get to the Medrash. but I'm pretty sure he does. I don't know. But we'll see. I've done the manuscript work here in terms of what are the different variants of the Midrashim. Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer has a list of three things. So it's actually kind of rare amongst the earlier Midrashim. Its list of three is name, language, and Brit Milah. Tana Dvei Eliyahu. Okay, now we're after the Muslim conquest already. 9th century. So it says, when Israel was in Egypt, they made a pact that they would do gemilut chasadim with each other, meaning there's like a certain social solidarity that you see here, that they're going to do right by each other. V'yishmeru b'levavam brit Avraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov. They're going to keep the brit of Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov in their hearts. Shelo yanichu lashon beit Yisrael avihem. They wouldn't abandon the language of Yaakov. V'yilmedu lashon Mitzrayim. And they wouldn't learn the language of Egypt, mipnei darkei avodah zarah, because language is a starter drug for getting into idolatry. Okay. And then you have the two Lekach Tov Midrashim. Lekach Tov was compiled by a Byzantine Greek writer also in the 11th century. can't remember his name offhand. So he compiles this Midrash called Lekach Tov. And he has two completely different lists. One, right, is in Shmot. V'lo hichilfu et simlotam. They didn't change their garb, the way they dressed. V'lo gilu et sodam. They didn't reveal their secrets. Reveal their secrets is connected to Lashon Hara, right? They didn't tell on each other, right? And the proof text, which I skipped, makes that clear. V'lo bitlu brit milah. And they weren't Mevatel Brit Milah. And then you have Lekach Tov on Dvarim. Now this Lekach Tov on Dvarim is, you probably have seen it quoted in a Haggadah, right? It's a gloss on the Sifrei, on the Medrash on Dvarim. One of the psukim that we said, that it's in Parashat Ki Tavo, Vahisham Legoi Gadol Atzum Varav, and the Medrash that we read at the Haggadah is Vahisham Legoi. Right, the Medrash is darshaning the pasuk. Vayisham legoy. There they became a goy gadol atzum varav. So it says, what does it mean to become a goy? And then what does gadol mean? And what does atzum mean? And what does rav mean? And each of those words is darshaned in the Haggadah. That's the whole Tseulamad section. Vayisham legoy. So the Sifrei says, melamed shayu Yisrael mitzuyanim sham, that the Israel was, you know, it doesn't mean, it's not like today where Mitsuyan is like a grade on your test. Mitsuyan means marked, distinguished, distinct, right? From the word tziyun, to sign something, to mark something. They were Mitsuyanim. They were, why? How did they distinguish themselves? This is Lekach Tov now speaking. Shaya Malbusham, Uma Achalam, Ulashonam, Mishunim Mimina Mitzrim. They had a different language, and they had different foods, and they dressed differently from the Egyptians. Misumanim hayu. They were marked. Yiduim shehim goy levadam chaluk ben Yisrael. It was known, it was obvious, it was apparent that they weren't like the Egyptians. Okay. So now, that's what we have, what we've got so far. We're up to like five different variants of these lists. And now we get to Bamidbar Rabbah. Most of Bamidbar Rabbah on the later part of Bamidbar Rabbah is basically a copy and paste from Medrash Tanchuma. And we only have Bamidbar Rabbah on Bamidbar and Naso. There's a fellow, Hananel Mack, wrote his dissertation on it. Says that Bamidbar Rabbah is basically two works that were stuck together. There's a medrash on Bamidbar and Naso, which is pretty long, and then there's a medrash on the rest of Bamidbar, which is basically just a copy of Bamidbar Rabbah on Medrash Tanchuma on Bamidbar. And at some point in like the 1100s or late 1100s or early 1200s, they got stuck together, and that became Bamidbar Rabbah. So Bamidbar Rabbah on Parshat Balak, on the story of, after the story of Bilam, says, so I'm reading from, if you see it says, Kushta Resh Ayin Bet. Okay? That means Kushta is a city. It's Constantinople. That was the Jewish name for Constantinople. Resh Ayin Bet is a year. That's 1512. That's the first printed edition of Medrash Rabbah. When the Medrash Rabbahs were put together, they were published as one book. They weren't published as five different volumes, even though they are five distinct works that were compiled, again, over the course of 600 years. They were published together. The first three editions, right? First, you have 1512 in Constantinople, and then you had two editions that came out in Venice, once in 1545 and once in 1564. And you can see it. It's the same in all three. Bizchut kama dvarim nigalu Yisrael mi Mitzrayim. It was due to several things that the Israelites were redeemed from Egypt. Shanu rabotenu, the rabbis taught. Bizchut dalet dvarim nigalu Yisrael mi Mitzrayim. Shaloshinu et shmotan. Veloshinu et malbusham. Velo gilu mistorin shalahem. Okay? And you can look at the Krakow version, the Krakow edition, Shin Samach Tet. That's 1609. Shanu rabotenu bizchut dalid dvarim. So now it's four things. Nigalu Yisrael mi Mitzrayim. Shaloshinu et shmotam. Shaloshinu et loshonam. Shaloginu mistorin shalahem. Etc. Right, we didn't get to the fourth. The fourth is a few lines later. Correct. Now I also have here Ktav Yad Paris. Right, this is a manuscript. Earlier, older than print. This is from the 14th century. It's hard to read. It says, Yilam denan l'rabanan bizchut kama dvarim nigalu Yisrael mi Mitzrayim. Shanu rabotenu bizchut arba'a anashim. Negalu Yisrael mi Mitzrayim, Shaloshinu et Shmotam, Veloshinu et Lishonam, Mishalo Galu Mistarin Shelahem. Okay, like the Krakow version, like the Krakow edition. What's that? Yeah, it's a strange thing, right? It's a strange, again, there are, these kind of things creep in. But I did look at a manuscript that I took a snip of, and it's like, it's amazing, by the way, how many of these manuscripts have all been digitized and are all online, either through Ktiv. I mean, like, you could sit there and it's like, yeah, I'm on the Vatican's website copying something from a... It's amazing stuff. We live in an amazing world. And there was a book that was published in the late 1500s called Ot Emet. And one of the things that he has, it's his glosses. He's writing in Greece. It's his glosses on the first printed editions of the Midrashim. And he has a gloss on this line of Malbusham. And he says very simply, Tzarich Lomar Levusham. And I went, I checked the manuscripts. It doesn't make any sense. There is no such tradition that it says Levusham or Malbusham. Talks about Malbusham and Simlotam. Okay, so I made a handy-dandy little chart here that summarizes all of these different midrashim, all of the different things on the list. They didn't change their name. They didn't change their language. They didn't slander. They didn't have promiscuity. They were kind to each other. They kept the covenant. They didn't change their food, and they didn't change their dress. And you can see that, number one, that the idea that they didn't change their dress is a late idea. It's first brought up in Lekach Tov, which is late. 1100s, late, you know, 11th century, late 11th, early 12th century. And you also see that there's not a single medrash, not a single one that has all three together, that has the three that Rav Asher quoted all together, that says name, language, and dress. Does not exist. Doesn't. No manuscript has it, no Girsa has it, no other Sefer has it, nothing. Okay. And now we get to, so where does it come from? So this next source is an interesting book. It's a book called Miturgamon. It was the first Jastrow. It was the first Aramaic. It was a work of Aramaic grammar, and you know, it just took a number of words from the Gemara and explained them, translated them. And in his Hakdama, he talks about the importance of the Aramaic language, that the Aramaic language is one of the Jewish languages. And you can see that the typeface is unique. Okay? It was printed in called Izni. It's near. It's not far from Nuremberg in Bavaria. This was a printing press owned by a Christian Hebraist named Fagius. I can't remember his first name right now. And he printed a number of Hebrew books for Christians, mostly books that would have been useful for Christians, right? So if you're a Christian Hebraist, having a book that's going to help you learn Aramaic and Hebrew grammar is very useful. So that's what he did. Now the author goes by a bunch of names. Elia Bacher, one of his names. Elijah Levita is another one of his names. His name was Eliyahu ben Asher Halevi Ashkenazi. Now, Ashkenazi means that he was German. And I think that this is a shiur in honor of my grandfather, whose name was Eliyahu Halevi. So to quote from a book by somebody named Eliyahu Halevi, I think is fitting, even though, as far as we know, we're not descended from this Eliyahu Bacher. And in fact, this Eliyahu Bacher fellow had only daughters. So if we are descended, we're descended from one of the daughters and not from the Levi line. But he was an interesting fellow. Okay, he's living in the 1500s, 1541 is towards the end of his life. He's about 70 years old at this point. So he's born in around 1471. He's a Renaissance man. I mean, he lived during the Renaissance. He spent most of his adult life sort of in this. He worked for a number of decades in the printing industry. He also, he lived and worked with various church figures and Italian noblemen, tutoring them in Hebrew. Okay, and even when he's working in the, and there were a lot of people who did this. Like this was like a cottage industry. You had this Renaissance fascination with classics and classical languages, and so they turned back to Greek and they turned back to Hebrew and Aramaic. But who do we know that knows how to speak Hebrew and Aramaic? Oh, well, you got these Jews. So they would hire these Jews to teach them and to tutor them in Hebrew and Aramaic. And so you have these, you know, you have these Jews that are learning b'chavruta with these either Renaissance thinkers or Christian thinkers, like at the beginning of the Protestant Reformation. So that's what Eliyahu Bacher is doing. Now, Eliyahu Bacher lived most of his adult life in Italy, Venice, for the last few decades of his life. But the printer that he was working for, the famous Daniel Bomberg, went out of business, and so Eliyahu Bacher was unemployed. And then he got an offer to work in the print shop of this guy, Fagio, or Fagius, in Germany. And he's like, okay, it's an offer I can't refuse. So he picks up, and he leaves his family, he leaves his wife, and he moved to Germany, to Izni, for 2 years. Now, the first book that he prints there is called Sefer HaTishbi, right, which is a Hebrew, it's a book of Diktuk, right? It's called Tishbi because, for two reasons, number one, it has 712 entries, which is the Gematria of Tishbi, and also his name is Eliyahu HaTishbi, very clever fellow. And he writes in the colophon, which is like the afterword. You know, at the end of the book, he writes a little something. So one of the things that he writes is about this book is that he had all the notes, but there were certain things that he wanted to go over. It was incomplete, and he didn't get a chance to do it because he didn't have any of his books with him. And even when he got to Izni, they didn't have a lot of books. Okay? There have been studies of what kind of Hebrew books were in Christian libraries in this period. In the year 1600, about half of Christian Hebraists in Europe had a Medrash Rabbah in their library. This is 60 years before that, and this was before the second edition. Right? The first edition of Medrash Rabbah is 1512. The second edition is 1545. This is 4 years before the second edition. So it was very, very unlikely that Foggio had a Medrash Rabbah in his library, or any Midrashim in his library. So when Eliyahu Bacher is sitting down to write his Hakdama, he's writing from memory. And he misremembered. He was a 70-year-old man. He had worked with Jewish books his entire life. He knew his stuff, but he's quoting from memory. And he invented a Medrash, probably by accident. And he said, Lo azu kemo sha'amru rabotenu zechronam levracha, shlosha dvarim lo shinu Yisrael b'mitzrayim, shmotam u'malbusham u'lishonam. And that's his version of the Medrash. Nagara malbusham ma'achalam lishonam. That's, it's not in the Haggadah. It's in Lekach Tov.
No, but let's say old manuscripts like that.
No.
There's no variation?
No, no. You have it in commentaries on the Haggadah, but that doesn't start until the 1800s. There's a few reasons that he's called Bacher. He writes that he has a Sefer called Sefer HaBachur, but apparently, like, you know, he writes, he's like, people called me Bacher. I don't know why, but I'm just going to embrace it. Okay. Sefer HaBachur was reprinted. It was printed in 1841. It was reprinted in 1541. It was reprinted in about 1560. Very popular work. And anybody want to venture when the next time it was reprinted was? What'd you say? 1842. More than halfway there. 1967. Okay? Wasn't printed for over 400 years. But it was around. People know of it, right? In fact, there was a return to it. I found two attempts. There were two attempts to republish it. Once in Berlin in 1787. Once in Prague in 1813. These were both hubs of Maskilic activity. And there was an interest in, a renewed interest in Hebrew grammar. Okay? And in terms of, let's say, halachic works, there are a few that quote it. The Prima Gadim quotes it on a number of occasions. Interestingly enough, one of the Lubavitcher Rebbes, one of the earlier, I think that Tzemach Tzedek quotes it a bunch of times. And probably most interesting is that the B'nai Yisachar, in one of his books, quotes it a number of times. It's like, B'nai Yisachar, wait a second, he's a Galatian Chassidish Rebbe. It's like, well, that's exactly right. That's where we're going. So if you look at the next source, this is Menachem Tzion. Now, Menachem Tzion, I'm sad that Chaim Cohen isn't here tonight, because he's an anical of the Riminover. This is a sefer by Rav Mendel Miriminov. Now, it wasn't published in his lifetime. Rav Mendel of Riminov died in 1815. This book was based on notes that were taken by Rav Yecheskel Panet between 1806 and 1809, when he became a chassid. And then he compiled it, and then it was published another 10 years after Rav Yecheskel Panet was passed away. Okay? And he works it into his social critique. He works this medrash, this Shem Lashon Malbush, into his social critique. Okay? He says, he's commenting on the pasuk that says that in Akev, Na'alchalo Batseka Ze Arbaim Shana. For 40 years you've been wandering in the desert, your clothes haven't worn out. So he says, wait a second. We know that when the Jews left Egypt, they all took the clothing from the Egyptians. And they had 50 camels worth of, 50 donkeys worth of, 90 donkeys worth of stuff that they took out of Egypt. Why couldn't they just change their clothes? Why do they need a miracle? And he says that that's the whole point. They didn't run after this new styles. Kiminago olam bezman hazeh, like everybody does today. Asher chadashim labkarim mitchadshim l'shanot signonot malbusheim b'chol yom mishuna b'chavero. They didn't change styles every 5 minutes like today. Oh, now it's double-breasted suit, single-breasted suit, who knows? No. Zaya chesed neurim shamru chazal b'shvil gimel dvarim nigalum yitzrayim shaloshim shmam l'shonu malbusham. Okay? And he goes on to talk about how nowadays, right? Nowadays, kamo begalut hazeh asher rabim kilkalu l'chadesh b'chol yom malbush nachrim v'ot otam lo yatsum in Mitzrayim. The ones that didn't leave Egypt were the ones who, like today, are changing their clothes to be like the non-Jews. Okay. He's writing this. This is based on basically shalashutis fashas that he gave in the first decade of... A little bit of biography here is important. Rav Mendel of Rimenov was from Germany. There are Hasidic legends that he knew Mendelssohn in his past. Agnon even quotes one. He probably didn't know Mendelssohn, but there's enough evidence that he was German. Rav Yecheskel Panet, his student, what eventually became the Rav of Transylvania, but before that, he was originally from Silesia, and he learned in the yeshivas in Prague for 3 years when he was about 19 to 21, right, in the early 1800s. And while he's learning in those yeshivas, he has three smichas, and we have some of his correspondence from there. And he's corresponding with the very same people. One of the people he's corresponding with is Rav Baruch Yetlis. It was Rav Baruch Yetlis' brother who was the one who wanted to republish Sefer HaMeturgeman. Okay? We're talking about people who, this is in their orbit. These are not people for whom Western German culture is foreign. In fact, both of them, you know, if the trend was to migrate from Eastern Europe toward the West, both of them started off in Central and Western Europe and migrated east, back toward Galicia, which is where they both ended up, you know, Galicia and then Hungary, or Transylvania, right? So they're bucking the trend. They're developing this idea, right? And you can see it even in what Rav Mendel is writing. He's saying very clearly, like, I've seen this. I know what they're about. I know what it is. I know where it leads. This whole, we're changing we're changing our clothes every day. And he doesn't see it as the idea of changing clothes, of adopting an Egyptian style of clothes. It wasn't about assimilation. It was about histapkut b'mu'at. It was about, in a certain sense, what he felt would be tzni'ut, right? There's no sense of histapkut b'mu'at. There's no sense of why would you want to change your clothes every day, even if you can afford it, right? He sees it as a value he sees austerity as a value. Okay, the third member of this group that sort of revives the Medrash is also somebody who's in Central Europe, probably most famous Central European rabbi of his time, also at the beginning of the 1800s, and that's the Chatam Sofer. And in his commentary on the Haggadah Shel Pesach, which was first published in 1850, and also in his Drashot, and we have the Pinkasim, we have the notebooks that he wrote them in, and these are already going back to the late 1700s, he's also referring to this Medrash of Chazal, of Lo Shinu Shmam L'Shonu Malbusham. Right? So you have three Central European rabbis who are familiar with what's going on in the world of Haskalah, who are aware of what's going on with, you know, they know of this book, Sefer HaMeturgeman. And all three of them are sort of taking it and adopting it for their own needs. Okay? We're going to skip the next, if you look in the middle of the last page, Ha'arot Shlomo Baber L'Mechilta, there's a whole bunch, and this is one example there's a whole bunch of maskilim who start fighting against it. He's like, that medrash is corrupt. That medrash is a mistake. That medrash doesn't exist. The whole thing that they didn't change their languages, the whole thing that they didn't change their clothes, it doesn't exist nowhere, right? And you see what he says. Hamamar hashagur b'fi rabim. The thing that everybody is saying. And the first person that I think see that says shagur b'fi rabim is Moshe Kunitz in 1819. Right? Saying, this that everybody's saying, lo shinu et malbusheihem, that they didn't change their clothes, in zecher imenu b'shum makom, nobody talks about that anywhere, gam ha-meturgam on ta'ab hazeh, sefer ha-meturgam on, made a mistake. And you see, he sums up, zeh lo amru chazal me'olam, chazal never said such a thing. They never said that you're not allowed to change your clothes. It doesn't happen. Okay. This was a fault line, right? We know that there's this split in Hungary and in the Habsburg realms throughout the 1800s. This became a myth. This became a foundational narrative of what ended up, you know, what we now know as ultra-Orthodoxy or Charediyut, right? Starting with Akiva Yosef Schlesinger, who we're not going to really get into, but in the mid 1860s, right, this becomes a rallying cry. This becomes a rallying point. These three elements become definitive of what it means to be a Jew. Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger even says, right, and it's a jarring thing, that shame, lashon, malbush are like the guf, right? Kol ha-mitzvos hem rak kilavush below guf. All of the mitzvos are like levush on top of the body. Ki ela dvarim hem gufa Yisrael. But these three things, they're the guf of Yisrael, right? That the guf is the levush is guf, and the guf is levush, right? What it means to be, what does a Jew do? A Jew does all the mitzvos. But what is a Jew? Somebody who talks like a Jew, has a name like a Jew, dresses like a Jew. That was what it became. That's what it meant. And it's even today, you can go through in this off the derech literature. People talk about their past. They say, like, our community starts with the belief that the Jews in Egypt didn't change their name, language, and dress. And I have a whole list of, like, Lippa Schmelzer talking about it, and Shulam Dean talking about it, and somebody giving a tour of Borough Park to some travel show where they talk about not changing name, language. It's bavust. It's everybody. It becomes part of the cultural heritage of what it means specifically in Hungary. Since World War II, it's expanded somewhat to, you know, I heard it when I was a kid growing up, and I think it's percolated through all of Orthodoxy, but that really doesn't start until after World War II. So we can now circle back to Rav Usher. Why does Rav Usher quote this Medrash? Because this is part of what Rav Usher is. This is part of the framework, part of the narrative, part of the mythos within which, you know, which defines his world. So he can't ignore it. But at the same time, he's not a cloistered chassid who doesn't know what's going on in the world. He sees that there are Baal Batim, you know, in America who are Yirei Shamayim and Shomer Torah Mitzvos and Talmidei Chachamim who happen to be named Harry. And he looks and he says, you know, it must be that when it said Shem Lashon Malbush, it meant one and not the other. Meaning he's looking for a way to specifically be Matarets that version of the Medrash, because that's the version of the Medrash that became part and parcel of the legacy of what it meant to be a Jew in Hungary starting in the mid-1800s. So I think that this is the quick version there's more to discuss here, like what it means that it's a mythos, but I think that this is enough to get a taste of where does this come from, how did it develop through history, and how does it even shape halachic writings of contemporary poskim. Thanks.